We really believe it. Our time is now, here in the morning of our lives. I want to say a little more. Dear, I asked Leroy and Ace and D Sharp and they said, don't you love her too? Then tell her she's okay.
Yes, it is.
Okay. That's right, Dion. You're all right. Tell her she's all right.
You're all right. You're all right.
That's right. You're okay, dear. There's nothing to feel inferior about. You can do it. And our time is now. We can do anything you really believe in. I know it. Our time is now. Here in the morning of our lives. Give me one more, give me one more. Our time is right now. You can do anything you set your heart on. Our time is now. Here in the morning of our lives.
Yeah, who is the person who recognized Jonathan Richman?
Isabella.
Wow, well done. That's it. I could play this to English people and anybody who's who's younger than me, and nobody ever recognizes Jonathan Richman. Something inspiring from the late 1970s. So, welcome back. I'm sure you must be almost as exhausted as I am. I record for the people who were on Cook as well. I recorded the class on Cook, so I'll put that up on the blog. And I'm recording this class now, so the MP3 will be up there. And so yeah, don't hesitate to say things or to to put them into the chat. If necessary. So we've got another hour to look at, and questions are most welcome, because methodology is always something that, you know, is everybody has different questions. But I have a few more things to say again about basically about favorite mistakes. And so if I can save my thing, that's not obviously not what I was trying to do. So let's try it again. There you go. So let's put that back there. Partager écran, partager l'écran. There you go. And if I come back over here. Sur le BBC. Okay, I'm intending to come back to more information about how I would recommend attacking the question of the BBC and competition. But I'm going to look at three or four other questions. And I'm not going to tell you in detail how I would tackle them, because I don't have time. But I just wanted to emphasize what I see as one of the big problems. And this is not making the question wide enough. And I mentioned that for the question of the BBC and competition, an easy mistake to make is to just, you know, look at the big competition of the commercial television and the big competition of the pirate radio, say, and just stay there. Whereas, in fact, the BBC and competition allows you to also say, oh, well, at the beginning, the BBC was set up because the authorities thought that competition was a bad thing. So this is a situation, so the beginning of the 20s, when the BBC didn't have competition but that still enters the question of the BBC and competition, because the two concepts, and they are linked, because the BBC rises because of this impression that competition is a bad thing. Because why? Well, because it will mean that the advertisers control which culture goes out to large numbers of people. Because if it was completely privatized, this was the impression of the elite that, you know, if you just let competition and the private companies do it, then this will mean that the millions will listen to probably jazz music and variety music and never listen to classical music and opera and so on. And so that whole episode of the 1920s can absolutely be mentioned in the BBC and competition, as long as you position it and show the link. And the link is that fear of competition, not fear of losing to competition, but fear of the bad effects of competition, was an important factor at the founding of the BBC. So let's have a look briefly at the BBC and government. And like I say, do ask questions. Now, unfortunately, because we have such a short time, I mean, you know, if I had 5 hours to do this, then I would ask each of you one by one to show me your suggestions. Well, we don't have time. Again, the BBC and government. And I'm looking at this one particular problem of drawing your question, your answer too narrowly. So perhaps saying a lot of good things, a lot of interesting things, but staying within a very narrow thing, the BBC and government. Well, the obvious thing to say is, well, times, one, how does the government control the BBC? Well, that's good, it's good. Well, they renew the charter, or they don't renew the charter, or they threaten to not renew the charter. They give the BBC a new channel, or they don't give the BBC a new channel, or they give a new channel to somebody else. And of course, you've got examples in here as well. All the things the government could do to control the BBC. And you could also fairly obviously talk about times when the government was unhappy with the BBC. Those documentaries. Oh, sorry, I missed an important one for the government controlling the BBC. MI5 and the secret vetting. Make sure there's no communists in there or people who are too friendly with communists. There was an official policy for many decades. So ways the government controls the BBC. Times when the BBC has made the government unhappy. Those documentaries in the 1980s. Times when the government has made the BBC happy. Mostly the Second World War, although Winston Churchill was often rather annoyed with the BBC. Winston Churchill was often rather annoyed with everybody. He was like that. But remember that if you have some examples of when the BBC made the government unhappy, they're not really, they're important, but they're not typical. Day after day, month after month, year after year, the BBC talks about the government and the government thinks it's okay, it's fine. And from time to time there's a clash. So it's important to know about the clashes, but it's important to know that they are from time to time. I remember having a student, quite an advanced student, who only took these bad things and concluded that the BBC hated Margaret Thatcher. Absolute nonsense, absolute nonsense. There was tension because the BBC had a different opinion. Of course, public service, very, very important to the BBC management. Margaret Thatcher not so happy with that. But the idea that the BBC generally put out programmes against Margaret Thatcher is absolute nonsense. There were occasional points of conflict. So all of those things that I've mentioned so far, I think I would expect quite a lot of candidates to find them. But what I want to emphasise, well, first of all, of course, we will have to find some examples from before the Second World War. So let's say the general strike, for example. That would be, because remember I told you, we don't want only examples from after the Second World War or only examples from before. Dangerous. We've had some radio and some television, okay. But what I'm thinking about, how you can extend it a little bit more to, well, the BBC and government. You are completely allowed to write a section on what activities of the BBC do not really depend on government. Do you see what I mean? It's just the two concepts, the BBC and government. Well, in fact, I would be tempted, as a third section, to say, often, accounts of the BBC put a lot of emphasis on relationships with government. However, the development of broadcasting also depended on many other factors. When the BBC in the 1970s, I did it on the video last week, invented a new idea, this news round, telling the news to children. Or when in the 60s they invented a new idea, play school, how to write television programmes for three-year-olds. Or when EastEnders decided, hey, yeah, let's look at social reality a bit more in detail, and yeah, let's have a gay character. Now, you know, we don't want to lose our audience, so we won't. But you know, let's explore this. Many important creative events in the history of the BBC, nobody asked the government's opinion. It was not a government problem. That there was a dynamic of communication, media, entertainment, education, and the broadcasting, the show, has its own dynamic, and the government intervene to make some things impossible. They don't want people to go too far. Huh? They don't want people to be telling defence secrets. They don't want people to be systematically being negative about the government, or they don't seem prepared to accept it from time to time. And the government don't want the BBC to cost too much money. And they don't want it to put really violent stuff on early in the evening so that children can see it, because they politically, you know, they don't want their voters to accuse, hey, you're the government, why are you allowing the BBC to put all this violent stuff on in the afternoon for children to watch? Your job is to take care of the population, yeah? So there's a whole load of things the government does. But this is more, it's more like a policeman in a way. It stops the BBC from going so far. It makes a frame. But inside that frame, when somebody says, hey, this is completely new, rock and roll, completely new in the 50s, nobody knew what to do with it. And when the BBC decided what to do with it, let's have the 6-5 special, that's an interesting music programme. I think we can find time, not much budget, but a bit of time late at night for the old grey whistle test, not much budget. There are people who will like that. The BBC didn't go and knock on the door of the government and say, oh, could you tell us about what you think we should do with music programming? Of course not. And the government certainly could not control in detail. The BBC since 1922 has produced over 1 million hours of programmes. Of course the BBC can. Just in the same way, in fact it's probably more free, but you could compare it to the education system. And I think it's a good comparison, because millions of children every day are taught in British schools. And millions of people every day watch the BBC or listen to the BBC. So these are huge, huge educational machines. And also other things as well, because you know, in schools, you also, especially in British schools, you also do a lot of sports. It's not just about learning history. Sport is extremely important in British schools. When I was at school, we did 6.5 hours of sport a week. Which is, I think that's more than in France in general. Yeah? And it's always been really quite a value. And, you know, just like the BBC does entertainment as well as education and information. So you could compare them. But probably the government controls a little bit more carefully schools. But even there, the government doesn't write the history books. Firstly, because people would be unhappy. The government's writing the history books. No. We want historians to write history books. Thank you. Huh? Because, you know, it's a delicate question. Now, of course, the government will try to choose among respected historians some historians to write the history and other ones not to. But they've got to be careful. They've got to have a certain amount of balance for a number of reasons. First of all, if it's just propaganda and not really history at all, then you will never have any good historians, because you know you'll only attract people who like repeating propaganda, who are not really very smart, you know. And so there's a whole load of reasons. So, but in many ways, the government controls quite more carefully the education system, but they absolutely don't even try to control what every teacher does in every classroom every day. Partly because it doesn't work like that. If you want some teachers, I know teachers don't always manage it, but if you want some teachers to be able to really interest and get excited some children, then you have to leave them some freedom. And that's similar in the BBC. So you know, that was just to say that when you begin your essay and you look at the BBC and government, remember that it's perfectly reasonable to say, however, there are many aspects of the BBC which are not closely controlled by government and cannot be closely controlled by government. Let's look at them. That's all I have to say about it. But do ask questions. But I really do notice this, that when I see people's essays, it's very often, I think it's because je suis toujours fasciné par l'idée du hors-sujet dans l'université française. Parce que, bon, les jeunes, plus jeunes que vous, mais en première année, en deuxième année, les étudiants me disent, ah, j'ai fait un hors-sujet. Et ils le disent comme si, oh oui, j'ai trébuché. Hein. Ça n'avait rien à voir, ça m'est tombé dessus un hors-sujet. J'y pouvais rien et tout d'un coup, j'ai fait un hors-sujet. Donc ça représente un peu qu'ils se sentent pas en confiance devant la question, quoi. Ils se sentent, ah oui, la question m'a fait quelque chose, je sais pas quoi. And so I think that the effect of that is that, you know, very often students are very frightened of going off the subject. But, you know, if you show the link, you know, the government controls the BBC in this way, the government influences the BBC in this way, the government's influence is not absolute. Look at all these examples when they were unhappy. And an important part of the activity of the BBC cannot be controlled by the BBC. Now, I didn't prepare that. I just made that up. I just improvised because I want to imitate and burn a little bit your situation. Now, it can be more difficult because look at this one. This is one of my colleagues from Clermont-Ferrand suggested. We have our special social media group on TikTok when we discuss how to teach the aggregation. That was a joke. Never mind. It's not on TikTok. This one, for example, this is the other kind of question. The sujet citationnel, as we say in formal French. So let's have a look at it. The 1936 Ulswater Committee reported that the position of the corporation is one of independence in the day-to-day management of its business and of ultimate control by His Majesty's government. Now, as I'm sure you can see that quite a lot of that question is the same as the one I just spoke about. What does the government do to the BBC? How do they control the BBC? How does it work? Now, if I saw this question, I don't know what you think about this question, but the most important thing when you see a question is not to panic, yeah, because it's difficult for everybody, you know. So just zen, yeah. Valium, zen. Okay, so let's have a look at this. The 1936 Ulswater Committee reported that the position of the corporation is one of independence in the day-to-day management of its business and of ultimate control by His Majesty's government. So here, remember, in any case, but certainly with the citationnel, you begin by defining all the terms. So, day-to-day management. What is it? Ultimate control. What is it? His Majesty's government. What is it? That's not a joke. I will come to that in a moment. The Ulswater Committee. What is it? Yeah. De toute façon, c'est obligatoire, vous commencez par là. Je crois que je l'avais déjà dit. I think I already said that even if you try to define the terms and you're not very good at it, that's better than not trying to define the terms. Not trying to define the terms is this is going to be bad. I can see they didn't define the terms. Bad first impression, yeah. So here, now this is slightly different because you have a paratext. The paratext is the 1936 Ulswater Committee reported that. So here in the first part, you will be able to say, obviously, what was the Ulswater Committee? And of course, ça vous permet, that allows you to write a paragraph on what are the committees of inquiry in general. What kind of people are appointed to them? How often do they happen? You don't need to give the list of all of them. You probably can't remember. I can't remember the dates of all the committees. But it's important to say, when it says the Ulswater Committee, that is not one. That is one of a regular every few years. Perhaps sometimes around every 10 years, but not absolutely regular. Who make a report Very often before the big decision, shall we renew the charter of the BBC, or shall we throw the BBC in the bin and do something else instead? Which was always possible. Again, this is the problem of the weight of reality. Because the BBC was always renewed, we tend to say, oh, it was inevitable, of course, the BBC was going to last for... In fact, at several points, many people were surprised that they didn't abolish the BBC. They abolished British Rail. They transformed the education system in the 80s and 90s, absolutely transformed it, allowing a much bigger role for private companies, a much bigger role for churches. Big, huge changes. There would have been nothing surprising about them abolishing the BBC. It wouldn't have been very surprising. Now, it gets harder as it goes on, of course, because the government says, oh, well, the BBC has organised the radio for 30 years. That's pretty good, but that's enough. We'll abolish it. That would have been easier than today. The BBC has lasted a century and has a worldwide reputation for excellence. Let's abolish it. Excuse me, Mr. Prime Minister, I think people will be unhappy. Yeah. So it's harder today. I'm not expecting the BBC to be abolished anytime soon, because the longer it lasts, the harder it gets. So certainly you would be talking about who are the committees and what do they do. With a bit of luck, you remember some of the people who were on the Ullswater Committee. I've forgotten, but I'm not passing the exam, you are. But I remember mentioning it in the thing. Okay, then day-to-day management. Shall we have more children's programmes or less children's programmes? Should we have regional news or national news? I'm inventing these examples, but you should give some examples of the kind of decision which are day-to-day management. And of course the result is that because the day-to-day management is independent, every now and then they come up with a documentary that makes Margaret Thatcher furious. Or a documentary that makes Harold Wilson furious. But sometimes it's just independence for the reason I mentioned, that, you know, in the 1930s, you know, they've got 40 hours a week programmes on three, is it three channels? Just two channels, on two channels. The government doesn't have time to look at the day-to-day management. Ultimate control, how does it work? How much should the licence fee be? The BBC doesn't decide. The government decides. Unhappy governments give you less money. And of course, renewing the charter or not renewing the charter. Nevertheless, so you can see that a lot of it is what I've already mentioned under the BBC and government, with an additional excuse here to talk about the importance of the committees of inquiry. And of course, 1936... What was important about 1936? What were the big broadcasting questions? Hey, somebody's invented television. Should we put lots of money into it? Where will we get the money? Should people who pay for listening to the radio have to pay for the research on television? That's not really fair, is it? Will the government give us some extra money to work on television? As you can imagine, developing television costs an enormous amount, yeah, because they didn't know whether it was going to work or not. So this is the beginnings of television. It's the charter was in 1927, the first corporation charter. So we're not surprised to see 1930. Ah, it's nearly time to renew the charter. Nearly time. 10 years it was. I'm pretty sure. You'll have to check the detail. So in this essay, you can say something about 1936. Something about the Ullswater Committee, something about committees of inquiry and their importance, and then go on to this question, day-to-day management, what is it? And here is your excuse to talk about education and information and entertainment, and in particular entertainment. You wouldn't expect the government to very often intervene and say, we're very unhappy with the entertainment. But they could do. But it's not the most common. Of course, the most common unhappiness of the government is about information, especially political information, because governments need to win elections, and then the ultimate control. So you can see there are things to say there. I must admit, personally, if I saw that question, I would be a little bit disappointed, because most of it is going to be about politics and rather less about the social and cultural. You can mention a bit of the social and cultural. For example, day-to-day management. Yeah, have a think about that. Now, in 1932, I've mentioned this in the videos, in 1932, the BBC decided that married women must leave the BBC. This is a management decision. So remember, management is a lot. It's personnel, it's programmes, it's news, it's a lot of things. So, for example, that's a social change, but you could notice that I mentioned that the reason why they decided to sack all the married women, which today is very shocking, but at the time was supported by many men and many women, because it was considered, well, yes, married women are supposed to be doing something else. Which was partly because housework was so hard before vacuum cleaners and fridges and supermarkets and detergents, that, you know, it was a full-time job. Yeah. And people had bigger families and so on, so it was a particular way of viewing the world, which was, in many ways, was very unfair to women, but was very very much accepted by people across society. So you might mention that as a management decision, but certainly you won't get a good answer if you don't spend the time at the beginning. Say, okay, day-to-day management. Let me see if I can find a series of quite varied examples of day-to-day management. What would be not good is if you said that if you didn't give any precise examples of day-to-day management. That would not be good. And the same thing, precise examples of ultimate control. I can think of one, although the governments always have always so far renewed the charter. Margaret Thatcher appointed somebody whose name I can't remember, to the Board of Governors, and his job was to sack the Director General, and he did. So that would be an example of ultimate control, quite strong. Ultimate control, also, as I said, the vetting, ultimate control, renewing or not renewing. I think the other thing that's very, very important, and this is difficult, because obviously, I mean, you don't have a huge amount of experience as historians, and so you have to, what would be a big mistake would be to talk about the committee's inquiries as if they were the voice of the government. They are not the voice of the government. Naturally, the government who appoints them chooses people who are not hostile to the government. Make sure that there is a majority who are not hostile to the government. That's obvious. Because remember, I think it's also important to remember the ideological structure. Conservative prime ministers are conservative because they think that conservative politics will make society better. And Labour prime ministers are prime ministers because they think that Labour policies will make society better. They are not pretending to be conservatives or pretending to be Labour politicians. Then the general aim of politicians is not to fill their own pockets with money. First of all, because in the elite, there are many easier ways of making a lot of money than becoming a politician, really. Much better to be the chair of a big company. But I didn't manage it, so I'm a history teacher. What can you do? That's what I have to say about that. Don't hesitate if you have any questions. But again, my main point was, don't rush in and say, okay, right, you know, the government control, I have three things to say. So the two things, make sure you draw your question wide enough, and secondly, make sure you are precise with your examples. So it would be a great pity to say, however, the BBC from time to time has made documentaries which make the Prime Minister unhappy. If you're not going to give a specific example of a specific documentary, maybe two. There are 10. You don't need to give 10, but two specific. Well, you need to give the name of a documentary, which I can't remember, but then I'm not passing the exam. You are, so that's okay. Okay, let me keep going and see what else I have here to play with. This again, these are suggestions from colleagues around the country. This is another sujet citationnel. Oh là là. I think this one is a little bit more difficult. Because like I said, the one about the government, at least it's very clear what you have to talk about, yeah? What does the government control? What does the government not control? And then you have to remember to, how can I say something about the social and cultural side? And I gave the example of the women. The ban on married women was not a government decision. The reason the BBC did it was because, you see, when they started in 1922, they were an avant-garde. It's like Amazon or Facebook as a company. They were very avant-garde, you know, Facebook. Oh, yeah, yeah, we have a gym in our building for the workers to go to the gym when they feel like it. Now, the BBC didn't do that. But it was an avant-garde industry that people joined because they were excited about broadcasting. It's like, wow, radio, I love it. I want to be in there, you know. That was the atmosphere. However, when the BBC, after 10 years, became much bigger, much more respected, more and more important personalities were willing to come and talk on the radio. Yeah. At the beginning, the radio, well, was that some sort of gadget for geeks? I'm not interested. And as the BBC became more establishment, then they decided to follow the big banks and the big insurance companies and the teaching profession and the civil services. I said, no, it's better if we don't have married women. Because if we have married women, well, we're not really supporting the family values that structure our society. C'est politique, c'est idéologique, comme ça. C'est pas juste. It's not fair on the single women, because they won't get promoted as easily if there are married women. It's not fair on the men, because men need a job so that they can feed their family, etc. Now, it was bad for everybody, really. It was especially bad for women, but it was actually bad for everybody. So let's have a look at this one. This is quite different, okay? Perhaps if I had thought more or known more, I would have tried to avoid the BBC becoming part of the establishment, capital E. But perhaps not. The establishment has a good deal to say for itself. And indeed, such a charge was surely a considerable tribute to the BBC that anything of such recent appearance should have attained such entitlature. Now, my word document dictionary is underlining entitlature, saying this word doesn't exist. It's a very, very rare word, okay? Such a title, it means. Yeah, such a title. John Reith quoted in 1972, in Andrew Boyle, "Only the wind will listen," Reith of the BBC. Now, here, I don't know if you agree with me, but it appears to me that this is, at the beginning, a little bit more difficult, because it's not really obvious straight away. Oh, yes, it's this and this and this. Oh, a lot more terms to define. You've got to define the terms, so let's have a go. Paratext and terms. Paratext, what can we get from the paratext? Lots of information from the paratext. In 1972, somebody wrote a biography of John Reith. Oh. John Reith left the BBC in 1938. And in 1972, somebody wrote a biography of him. Good. Je suis un petit peu surpris. Il devrait avoir en principe l'éditeur. Je ne l'ai pas là. C'est pas moi qui l'ai mis. Mais normalement, il y aurait l'éditeur. Et ce qui serait intéressant, je vais essayer de le voir, de le trouver plutôt. Je vais vous dire pourquoi dans un instant. Only the wind will listen. Only the wind will listen. Reith. Hutchinson. Ouais, ça ne nous donne pas grand chose. Quite an important publisher. The important thing about this, you know, so 34 years. Okay, now I am going to leave Rouen University in 3 or 4 years' time because I'm retiring. If 34 years later somebody writes a book about my time in Rouen University, hey, I will be very happy. So it shows what a tremendous mark he made on broadcasting that 34 years later they were wanting to write about it. That's one thing. He was still alive. So here is what he said. So he's reflecting after he's left the BBC, we assume. And so what is he said? Perhaps if I had thought more or known more, I would have tried to avoid. So what do we get from this? Well, first of all, he admits that he thought, he didn't think enough and he didn't know enough. And that's quite an important point. At the beginning, he was improvising. Everybody was improvising. Broadcasting was completely new. How do you do an interview? Well, I suppose you write down what your questions, and then the guest writes down their answers, and then you switch on the microphone and you read it. That's how they did interviews until the 1930s. For at least 10 years, every interview was scripted. And as we know, that makes for very poor interviews. It's much more fun to be spontaneous. So everything had to be learned. What is a disc jockey? I don't know. What is a news bulletin? I don't know. I suppose we read articles from the newspaper, don't we? So everything had to be invented, and that's just reflected in this thing that, you know, we didn't know so much. It was very experimental, and it attracted experimental people. I would have tried to avoid the BBC becoming part of the establishment. So here, Reith says, the BBC became part of the establishment. Okay. And so you have to say, well, what does that mean? What does that mean that it became part of the establishment? Establishment, capital E. Now, the establishment with a capital E tends to mean the powerful, the elite, the accepted by the elite. And this is interesting because the BBC was also a public service. A public service, it sounds like, for everybody. And the establishment, it sounds like, you know, many people think it's a good thing, the establishment, but it's not for everybody. It's supposed to be, you know, the domination of the people who perhaps deserve to dominate. It's quite a conservative idea. So John Reith does not say, oh, well, you know, people say the BBC is part of the establishment. It's not really. He says, yes, it is. But perhaps I should have avoided that, but perhaps not. So he's interesting. He still has some doubts about it, which is an interesting thing about John Reith. So you have to be able to say here, how was in our period the BBC part of the establishment? Well, I mean, certainly was part of the elite. I think my favourite example, which I mentioned in one of the videos, is when the first chairman of the BBC had his portrait painted, and he decided to have it painted with a sword and gloves. And it's, of course, it's just a detail. But I thought, you know, I mean, you know, I really, you know, it's like, oh, well, I just happen to have a sword. No, it is claiming a link to aristocracy. The reason, if you have your portrait painted in a costume like that with a sword, it's because you want to look like an aristocrat, whether you are or not. And so certainly, being part of the establishment was obvious to them. And indeed, here in this same quote, Reith says, well, people accuse the BBC of being part of the establishment, but this accusation, such a charge, you know, remember, you need to read the quotation several times. You need to make sure you've understood such a charge, that is, the accusation of being part of the establishment. Now, it's perfectly okay if you didn't understand that the first time you read it. But that's why you read it six times until you, oh yeah, such a charge. A charge, what charge? Oh, a charge that the BBC is part of the establishment. Okay. So he says, this is an accusation. The BBC is part of the establishment. Which critics make. And indeed, that book which I mentioned briefly, I think, by Tom Mills, The Myth of Public BBC, The Myth of a Public Service. He says, oh, the BBC serves the powerful and the elite. That's all it does. Hello there, little one. Hello. They always say never work with animals or children, but that's only because everybody wants to look at them instead of you, but it's fine. It's fine, you're welcome. Right, yes, and so he says, what is surprising is that the BBC should be called part of the establishment when it only arrived recently. Now, he's thinking in the 1960s or 70s, the BBC arrived in 1922, and he says it was only recent. This is because he's a conservative traditionalist, you see. that is, that from his point of view, something which is only 50 years old is a completely new thing. What are the important things for conservative traditionalists? The monarchy, it's been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. The Church of England, it was created in the 16th century. Now, this is the establishment, the values of the establishment, going right back. Yeah, the Union, the United Kingdom, created in 1801. And so he shows, in this sentence, he shows he is a traditionalist. Because he says, people say the BBC is part of the establishment, and the BBC is only recent. And anybody who says the BBC is only recent is either a conservative traditionalist or a historian, because we also, when we say recently, we mean in the last 300 years. Yeah, that's how historians think. But, you know, he's not an historian, so he's a conservative traditionalist. Yeah, those are the sort of things you would be looking at. So you also have in the previous sentence, the establishment has a good deal to say for itself. C'est une expression, c'est pas littéralement que l'establishment dit beaucoup de choses. C'est the establishment is in many ways a very good thing. Ça c'est le sens de la phrase. The establishment has a good deal to say for itself. Veut dire l'establishment a beaucoup d'aspects positifs. British cinema has a good deal to say for itself. Ça veut dire qu'il a beaucoup de qualité. That's his expression. So he shows himself to be a traditionalist there as well. You know, say, oh, the BBC is part of the establishment. Oh, well, that's good. Whereas Tom Mills, who is very left-wing, said the BBC is part of the establishment. It's not made for the people by the people. No, it's a elitist thing, you know, always defending traditional values and so on. It's no good for us. This is much more left-wing. Okay, so that's the sort of things that you would be looking at there. But perhaps the big section here is the BBC is part of the establishment. How can we show that's true? Well, I showed that the governor generals come from the elites. Almost all of them went to private schools, when in fact only 7% of the British population go to private schools, because they're very expensive now, so that's a clear part of the elite. Secondly, as political examples, like we don't want any communists in the BBC, that's an establishment way of looking at it. Supporting the government in the general strike, in the miners' strike of 1984, in general, when there's a revolt of any kind, the BBC is against it, either directly or indirectly. When they interview the managers of the companies, they interview them in their offices, and when they interview the strikers, they interview them in the car park. And anybody standing in a car park answering a question doesn't look as intelligent as the person behind a desk. Every framing is very, very. This is old. Everybody, this is old stuff. This framing is very important. Of course, they interview the strikers and the managers. But first of all, they are often more aggressive with the strikers. And secondly, the manager is behind a desk looking like a calm, intelligent guy. Whereas they find the striker who makes the most noise and says, will you shout a bit for us? Could you break a window? We want to film it. I'm exaggerating, but not that much. Not that much. These things do happen. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that. But don't hesitate to ask questions. I'm not giving you a full structure. I'm just going for one more here. This is a wonderful one. I'm just going for this is really illustrating some of what I said in last week's methodology class. Using the paratext, defining the terms, and making sure that you find a way to widen it so you can talk about broadcasting and about politics and about society. Those are the three bits. En général, ceux qui réussissent la création, c'est ceux qui font une brave tentative. Hein. C'est-à-dire que, quelque part, la question est au-dessus de la tête de 95% si, ne serait-ce que parce que vous avez dû étudier le BBC et aussi la littérature, la traduction. Hein. Vous n'avez pas eu le temps de le bosser comme les profs, parce que moi j'ai fait que la BBC et Cook, hein, mais je n'ai pas lu Henry James. Okay, another one. Our society's culture is now multi-ethnic and pluralist. That is to say, people adhere to different views of the nature and purpose of life and expect their own view to be expressed in some form or another. The structure of broadcasting should reflect this variety. Good. Okay. Whew. So this is like the BBC in diversity. Sometimes, in some ways, the citationnel, alors le citationnel, il faut savoir s'y attaquer, mais parfois c'est plus facile parce qu'on vous donne plus d'éléments. Donc, on recommence. The paratext. The Annan Committee. Ah. No, maybe, perhaps I can remember who were the most important people and what were their most important problems. Again, they mention the Annan Committee. This allows me to have one paragraph, not four paragraphs. Attention. One paragraph on the importance of committees of inquiry. That's context. One paragraph, because they only talk about one committee. Yeah. If the question was about committees in general, then I can have 10 paragraphs, yeah? But one paragraph, you're allowed. Souvent, si vous ne passez que 5, 6, 7 phrases, ce n'est pas un hors sujet. Vous faites le lien, et puis vous montrez. Yet the Annan Committee is one of a series of committees inquiries which had this importance and tended to intervene just before the renewal of the Charter and have seen broadcasting in very different ways. In very different ways. In the first committee, I can't remember which one, that's your job, the first committee allowed John Reith, the Governor-General, to sit on the committee. So it wasn't very independent. It was the last time. They never let the Governor-General sit on the committee again. So our society's culture is now multi-ethnic and pluralist. 1977. Okay, so here we need to know a little bit of British history. Multi-ethnic and pluralist. Now, of course, multi-ethnic, especially. There were black people in Britain in the 20s. But especially after the Second World War, the government encouraged Jamaicans and Trinidadians and West Indians in general to come to Britain. We need to rebuild London. A quarter of the buildings got bombed. The government encouraged or accepted many Indians and Pakistanis. Well, they were Indians at the time because Pakistani had not been invented when they decided to leave. Oh yeah, maybe just afterwards. Division of India and Pakistan in 1947. And independence, so lots of Indians and Pakistanis, very often small shopkeepers. And this was partly because employers were often racists. It could be easier to establish your own shop, and also it was something that you could do by very, very hard work. Yeah, that you get the whole family and you're open 12 hours a day or 15 hours a day, and you can survive where, you know, a normal shop open from 9 to 5 might not. So multi-ethnic, in the 70s, this is not an accident, 1975, 1976, the extreme right was on the rise. The National Front was on the rise. It never got to the heights that it did in France. But in local elections, you got 30% in this town, 20% in that town for the National Front, whose politics were very similar to the French for National. Now, this was only in a few towns, in 10 towns. But nevertheless, it was on in all the newspapers, this idea that, because the crisis had come and there was a lot of unemployment, there's always some people, especially stupid people, who are looking for, whose fault is it? Oh, is it the fault of the Jews? Is it the fault of the blacks? Oh, it must be one of them. Is it the fault of the Muslims? Yeah. And so there was a rise in far-right activity. And so it's perhaps not an accident that this is the time when the Annan Committee, and perhaps you would remember some of the people on it, I don't now, but I would do if I was taking the exam. So they're actually, now this is an official committee reporting to the government saying our society's culture is multi-ethnic. That's quite new. I don't think a 1960s committee reported would say this. Now everybody knew that there were black people and Indian people present, but there was a lot of assimilationist ideas. Well, they ought to resemble us, really. Yeah? Whereas multi-ethnic and pluralist, this is the beginnings. Notice they don't say multicultural, but that's on its way. Multiculturalism is on the rise. And they say here, the structure of broadcasting should reflect this variety. And so, obviously, what you have to be able to do is give examples to show it does. Well, Well, and you don't have to stay in the 1970s. You should start in the 1970s. Well, even in the 1960s, the BBC was producing television programmes, especially in Gujarati and in Punjab, in Asian languages. In the 1970s, however, well, the some of the sitcoms were really pretty racist. And by the 1980s, however, again, that's too many howevers, but you know what I mean, you got examples like EastEnders introducing black families in a sort of program which is very positive. Soap operas about looking at people who are like us. And so to put black people in a soap opera in the 1980s meant, hey, everybody, these people are like you. That's the meaning of a soap opera. It's about, in the soap opera, nobody's a star. They're just ordinary people. They're just like us. That's why we like them. Yeah. So that's just some examples of how it worked. And of course, there are examples of how it didn't work. Now, it said multi-ethnic and pluralist. You should compare back, yeah? Let's compare this briefly, one paragraph, with what John Reith would have said. Pluralist. Multi-ethnic was not a big discussion point in the 1920s. But pluralist, I don't think John Reith would have liked the idea of pluralist. Pluralist, no, we want Christian values. No music on a Sunday. Oh, classical music, okay. Yeah, we want a religious service every day. Yeah. Pluralist, well, no, we just want good culture. And we will put the good culture on the radio and so everybody can have it. What do you mean pluralist? Of course, some people disagree. That's because they're horrible people. You know, John Reith was not a guy who was going to say that the view of the world is pluralist. He was saying, no, what's pluralist? The British Empire is wonderful. Let's hope it gets bigger and bigger. It was an old-fashioned guy, you know. And so this quotation allows you to talk about the committees of inquiries, and then talk about this pluralist, this recognition of pluralism, which is very 1970s because of the context, and is not very 1920s or 1930s. And also, pluralist is very wide, of course, because pluralist also would include, for example, the inclusion of more popular culture. In the 70s, pop music from 67, pop music is massive on the BBC radio, massive. In the 20s and 30s, the BBC accepted that they were obliged to put some popular music on the radio, unfortunately. And if you remember, the music department did not deal with popular music. They didn't think it was music. They had a separate department, light entertainment. Not very polite, is it? Light entertainment. Whereas, so pluralism included more people with regional accents. No more of the BBC English where you must speak like you're the Queen. Much less of it anyway. So pluralism. So this is about spending time on the quotation. You look at pluralist, and with a bit of luck, after a few minutes of thinking, after the panic, 5 minutes panic, and then you move on to thinking. He said pluralist. Well, obviously multi-ethnic, but he says multi-ethnic and pluralist. What other kinds of variety have become introduced into the BBC? And the one that comes to my mind mostly is regional and class. That is to say that John Reith said in so many words, he said, the people we want on the radio are people who know more than everybody else. We want experts. We don't want anybody else on the radio if they're not experts in their field. Whereas the soap opera or the radio ballads that I mentioned of Ewan McCall or other documentaries today, we expect to sometimes see ordinary people on television, and this will eventually be linked with a movement to reality TV, but that's after 1995. But certainly today, if you say, okay, we're doing a documentary and it's about the daily life of nurses in the COVID epidemic. And most people say, oh, well, that's a good idea that they have that on the television. This is the idea of pluralism. You know, okay, yeah, of course, we want some professors, but we also want some ordinary people to learn about their lives. Now, and indeed, it's very interesting, I was looking at something on the television about a terrible situation somewhere in Africa, homelessness. and they interviewed several people who didn't have a home. And I'm very old, but back in the 1970s, they would only interview the white people who were the head of the charity helping them. They would never interview somebody local, but first of all, they wouldn't bother to learn the language. The white journalists would just go in and talk to the... because it was just, that's just the way that they did things, yeah? And it is quite shocking, but it's you just... today, if you do, even if you do it in France, you know, if you do a documentary about homelessness in Paris, you will interview some homeless people. That's what people will expect. Not only, they will also be experts and ministers, but also some ordinary people. But that wasn't the case 50 years ago. And the BBC is the same there. Okay, so that could give you some ideas. You still have a chance to ask questions if you wish. I know that's all a lot of information. It's not always easy to ask questions. You are allowed to send questions. Which didn't give me time to come back to the BBC and competition, but I will do something about that. I might do one of the videos about the BBC and competition to give you a take on that, because I have a lot of good material on that. Are any of you also following the CNED? Est-ce qu'il y a des gens qui suivent également le CNED? Ça arrive de temps à autre que les gens ont envie de... Non, c'est-à-dire que ça vous suffit largement le nombre de cours que vous avez. Ah, oh, je comprends. C'est, mais bon, ça arrive. OK. OK. OK, good. OK. OK. Woof. Well, I'm going to switch the recording off.